Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED. My father-in-law spent his early childhood in a prison camp. Like a lot of other Japanese Americans during World War II, he and his family were sent to live behind barbed wire. They were considered enemies of the United States. But he doesn't talk about that painful time much. He did tell my kids, his grandkids, about a memory of seeing fireflies glowing in the nighttime sky at the camp in Jerome, Arkansas. It was something he'd never seen in the Central Valley of California. There's a lot of silence from Japanese Americans of his generation about that period in history. It's hard to really imagine what it was actually like for kids growing up in these prison camps, or for their parents. I'm Sasha Coca, and today on the California Report magazine, we're going to hear from a therapist specializing in trauma who also spent her earliest years in a prison camp. She's written a new book based on actual letters and diary entries her parents wrote during that time. And it really gives us a window into what was happening raw and in the moment, real time, in their own words, in a way I've never seen before in a book about Japanese American incarceration.
Every morning, my feelings don't lift, so it's just as well to have to stay inside with my sick children. These days, nothing gives me more strength than your letters.
Satsuki Ina is a former professor at Sacramento State, and her first book, coming out this month, is called The Poet and the Silk Girl. And in it, she writes about how she and her brother were born in an incarceration camp in Tule Lake in Siskiyou County near the Oregon border, and how they moved to different camps throughout her early childhood.
I don't have any memory of being in camp. I do remember leaving. So my earliest childhood memory is being on the train. So I remember that it was hot and sweaty, and seeing my brother laying his head across my mother's lap. And I'm standing in the aisle with my arms holding onto the armrests of the seats on either side, swinging back and forth. There's a man there who I'm told is my father, but I don't know him. He's not familiar to me. I'm actually a little afraid of him because I hadn't seen him since I was a baby, essentially.
Because he was sent to another prison camp. Your family was separated in this process.
Yes. Separated for 18 months. So when you're almost three, 18 months is a huge part of my life. So yeah, he was a stranger to me.
Well, part of what this book does is, you know, it's so personal. It actually recounts that period of separation between your parents and your family. And it's through this really incredible primary source material of letters that they wrote each other. How did you come across those letters?
Yeah, they were letters and my mother's diary. She kept a diary every day during their incarceration. So after my father died, my mother and I were cleaning out his desk, and in the back of the bottom drawer was a bundle of letters that were wrapped in string, and she and I were looking at them, and she was, like, shocked. She said, "I didn't know that Daddy saved my letters." Then she was looking around, and she said, "Somewhere around here, I have the letters that Daddy sent to me."
"Dear Itaru, day after day, all I do is look at the calendar. I put the pictures along with our memories from Klamath Falls in the album. For the rest of our life, let's live together with that same feeling of harmony."
Your parents were both Kibe Nisei, which means they were born in the U.S., but their families sent them back to Japan for a while when they were kids. So they had that shared experience. And those early letters were actually love letters from when they first met, before World War II.
So my mother was in Japan visiting her grandmother, who raised her during that period of time when she had been sent to Japan. And at that time, the Japanese silk industry was booming and was going to be the first time they were entered into the International Exposition in the U.S., the Golden Gate Exposition, it was called. It was on Treasure Island.
The spirit of the Golden Gate International Exposition is symbolic of the bridges that span San Francisco's bay. First, the Golden Gate Bridge.
And so she was selected out of 10,000 young women to be one of the silk girls. So she was sent to represent Japan's silk industry. So one day her watch broke, and she was accompanied by someone who was supposed to stay with her. And that person took her to the watchmaker in San Francisco, Japantown. This watchmaker invited my mother to come back to have dinner with him and his wife. So when she went back, she was introduced to a young bachelor who is also a Kibe, very active in the San Francisco Buddhist temple there. And so they met, and I don't know if they would say it was love at first sight, but shortly after that, they were engaged, and my mother went back to Japan to finish up her job, say goodbye to her grandmother, and then came back to San Francisco, Japantown, to marry my father.
Shizuko-sama, the World's Fair Sun Tower has still not been taken down, so I can see it from my office window. We will never forget the World's Fair. It was here that I was able to meet you. And now we are together to share the blessings and the struggles of life. Our love will live forever.
We should say those are clips from a 2005 documentary that you made about your parents called From a Silk Cocoon. And those are voice actors reading their letters and poems. And so your mom was the silk girl. This book is called The Poet and the Silk Girl. What's the poet part?
So my father was a haiku poet from the time he was a teenager, actually. He'd been writing poetry and was very active in the San Francisco Bay Area haiku poetry associations, the organizations for Japanese American poets.
I made this haiku to remind me of that day we said goodbye at Klamath Falls, but I haven't polished it yet, so please don't make fun of it. Imoto sakaru, kramas no no, kari ikeri, saying goodbye to my sweetheart at Klamath, wild geese depart.
So your parents had this romance, they did end up getting married, and then 9 months later, Pearl Harbor was bombed. They were living in San Francisco. And your mom has a diary entry about that.
The weather was nice, so while I was waiting for Ina to return home, I baked a chocolate cake. It was about 1:40 p.m. that I heard Japan, Japan, repeatedly on the radio. I turned the volume up to listen to the radio. It was announcing that Japan had dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor at about 8 a.m. this morning. The war between Japan and America has begun. All of a sudden, I started feeling nervous and worried. And then Ina came home, very upset, saying, "The war has started. This means trouble."
So it was this very sudden shift where they were American citizens living their lives in San Francisco, and then overnight, they were considered enemies. And one of the things I find so poignant about this book is you have incredible photographs in here. And there is a photograph of your mother that Dorothea Lange took. You can just see the uncertainty in her face. Did you know about that photo? Did you know Dorothea Lange had photographed your mom?
It's 1988. My mother mentioned it. Someone had called her and said that her picture was in a calendar that was being published by the National Japanese American Historical Society. And they sent me the calendar, and there was the photograph of my mother standing in line, waiting to get her the number that was going to be assigned as her identity for the duration of her incarceration. And it turned out that photograph was taken by Dorothea Lange.
You've also got some diary entries from your mom as she's going through that process of leaving and being sent to Tan Phran Racetrack, which was just south of San Francisco. She was newly pregnant with her first child, your brother, Kiyoshi.
Army announced all Japanese people who live between California and Sutter Street must evacuate to Tan Phran Racetrack. It means us. We left San Francisco on Greyhound bus. I could not describe my feeling in words.
So when they got to Tan Phran, I think my mother was shocked to discover that they were going to be housed inside the horse stalls, where there was evidence that the horses had recently been removed. The smell lingered, and she was extremely morning sick. And this was a memory that she never forgot. And she didn't talk about the camp experience very much, but she did talk to us kids about how sick she became, but also how it began to become a reality that they were going to be treated as less than human.
May 1942, in bed with cold and fatigue, first time I went to dinner. Holding their own dish and lining up for food made me think of prisoners. It is a sad picture of war. Menu: bread, boiled potato, several pieces of sausages. I had two helpings secretly. It is against the rules, but I am hungry.
They could look through the fence and see people enjoying their Sunday afternoon, that people were pushing their babies in baby buggies and cars were driving by while they were imprisoned and had lost their freedom. She talked about how people would come, some neighbors that they knew, but also strangers that would come on the weekend tossing fruits and vegetables over the fence because they couldn't get fresh fruits and vegetables. And then one day, she said, a woman who likely saw that she was pregnant motioned her to come closer, and with this, I think, enormous strength, heaved this hand-quilted cotton blanket over the fence to her and then said to my mother, "I hope this helps." And she always remembered that, so that when she was ill and failing, she still had the blanket on her bed, and I said, "Let's get rid of this blanket. Let's get you a new blanket." And she grabbed the blanket in her hand and while she was laying there, and she said, "No, I don't want a new blanket." I get a little choked up when I talk about this. I asked her, "Why is this so important to you?" I knew the story. She had told me the story, but she said, "This blanket helped me to remember that someone outside cared."
And she kept it for decades.
Right. And it's very raggedy. I still have it. But it is a moment that I have carried with me in my work today, that someone outside cares how much it matters to people.
So when you're talking about, you know, pregnancy and labor for your mom in the camps, one of the things that struck me is that, you know, you literally were in utero in your mother's body during this period of incredible anxiety mm-hmm. for her, and that you were basically stewing in that, in her body. You know, I'm sure that's a lot to unpack as a therapist who specializes in trauma.
Yes, that, you know, there's research that shows that the trauma that the mother is experiencing, and as she is experiencing trauma, releasing all these stress hormones, the cortisol, the adrenaline that is just rushing through her body, creates a huge impact on the fetus, the emerging baby. So I would say that I inherited from that very low tolerance for anxiety. I think I became a therapist because of it, trying to understand myself mm-hmm. and my own easily triggered stress and response to threat. So this is kind of the chemical transmission.
And part of the trauma for your parents was that they were branded as disloyal to the U.S. In fact, you explained that Tule Lake was a camp that was a segregated prison for Japanese Americans whose answers to a questionnaire were answers the U.S. government didn't like.
The loyalty questions were the two that were the most significant. One was, will you forswear your loyalty to the emperor and to Japan? And the second was, would you be willing to bear arms to protect and fight on behalf of the United States? So for my parents, they had never had loyalty to the emperor. So they answered no, because they were American citizens. Would they bear arms? And they answered no, because my father's belief was, if you give me my constitutional rights back, I will do whatever you ask me. But until that time, the answer is no. In that way, they were then labeled as no-nos and disloyal. And so the Tule Lake prison camp in Northern California was designated a segregation prison camp for those who were disloyal. What happened was the government defined dissidence as disloyalty. So loyalty was actually never an issue for my parents. They were American citizens. They loved this country. When Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, my parents, you know, were helping at the Red Cross and, you know, were dismayed that the enemy had bombed their country. So this whole issue of loyalty was an artificially constructed message to minimize any resistance to the incarceration.
There's a passage from your mom's diary about that moment where she and your dad decided they were going to stand up for their civil rights rather than answer those two controversial questions with yes.
We decided to fight for our civil rights. A resolution was made and sent to Washington, D.C. by telegraph. The fight has started.
There is still a narrative in our community that dissidents were disloyal. And so my hope is that this story will bring light to the fact that maybe it wasn't, my parents wouldn't think of themselves as heroic necessarily, but definitely feel like they stood up for what they believed in. They had tried everything to try to maintain their innocence and their rights to their freedom and their constitution. So at that point in their lives, my mother writes, because my children have a Japanese face, I don't want them to be Americans. So they came to a place where they would renounce their American citizenship, hoping that by going back to Japan, where they had some of their childhood experience, that their children would have more opportunity, more possibility of living without harm.
So they decided they'd rather raise their kids in Japan than in a U.S. that would treat their kids with racism. And after that, you know, this kind of crackdown on people like them, considered dissidents, became much more intense within the camp.
Internal security came over with an arrest warrant for Ina. 50 members of our group received the same warrant. There's a rumor that they will go to Bismarck, North Dakota.
Your dad was actually segregated with other men, first inside a jail within the Tule Lake prison camp. And you saw a photograph of him years later at the Smithsonian, held in that jail with other men. Tell us about that moment.
I turned the corner in the museum, and there was this very large photo of men behind bars in a jail. And I immediately recognized my father standing there. And I burst into tears because I didn't know until then that he had actually been put in jail in Tule Lake and then shipped off to Bismarck, North Dakota, which was a Department of Justice internment camp for enemy aliens. I knew we were in camp. I didn't know he had been in jail inside of the camp. And so when I did more research, actually found the photo of my father's mugshot, I could see the bruises and cuts all over his face and neck. So there were some photos that had been taken by Robert Ross, we think, who was an administrator in the camp who was sympathetic to the people. These photos captured guards with bats beating people in the jail. And the dates lined up with when my father was incarcerated. So I know that my father was one of the victims of that violence. That, you know, triggered for me, like, we don't really know what happened to our family. My father never spoke about that.
The other night, Kiyoshi sneaked your picture to his bed. Then he came running to me and cried, "Mommy, Oto-chan's shoes are gone and his feet hurt and are bleeding." Of course, the picture does not show the bottom of his daddy's body, and so the shoes don't show. I try to explain this to him, but he doesn't seem to understand that his Oto-chan is gone.
That's a letter where your mom is telling your dad about your brother Kiyoshi, who was a toddler at the time, and was really acting up after your dad, who he called his Oto-chan, got sent away to another prison. A lot of these letters that your parents exchanged were actually censored. Japanese-speaking censors would take scissors and cut holes in the letters. You've got pictures of some of those in the book, as well as pictures of letters that they managed to get past the censors in some pretty ingenious ways.
My mother said that my father would shred the bedsheets, and then he would write on these cloth letters and then stitch them inside some part of his clothing. So she said inside the pants pocket linings or inside the belt linings. And then he would write her a letter and say anything reference to repairing his pants, that she knew there would be a letter secreted somewhere in there.
"I sent the pants because the waist is too small. Please fix where the belt closes. It is getting cold, so please send it in a hurry."
Many of these letters were written in Japanese, and you had to work with a translator years later to try to unpack them. Tell me what that process was like.
While I was teaching in the graduate program at California State University, Sacramento, a young woman, graduate student, was in the program. She was from Japan. She was bilingual. You know, it's kind of more co-translating because she didn't have much knowledge about the Japanese-American incarceration experience. So where she would say people gathered for dinner in the dining room, I would have to say these were military-style mess halls. These were not bathrooms. These were latrines. Because she could do these amazing translations where she could open up the letter and she could do this simultaneous translation. And she paused at one point, and I looked over at her, and she was crying. And I was shocked by my own response. I reached over and I grabbed her and I said, "Iko, you cannot cry. Do not cry. How am I going to get through this?" And then we both started crying. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I backed up and I realized how I had been so defended against the emotional level of the story that when it was leaking through her, it kind of opened the door to my own heart, my own, you know, I think there was a longing to know and also a fear of knowing. I realized that this was not just my story or just my family story, that this weaving together the idea of collective historical trauma was an important way of looking at what happened to us and why even today we are suffering the consequences of that trauma. There's some theories that say it can go on for seven generations until and only if it is processed, talked about, researched, unearthed, confronted.
Tonight, these heartbreaking images from the southern border are sparking growing outrage. Thousands of migrant children being separated from their parents. And now, newly released audio.
When the news was showing how children were being ripped from the arms of their mothers and how families were being incarcerated and being treated as if they were criminals, it spoke not just to me, but it spoke to my Japanese-American community. We went to Laredo, which is a border town, because we had learned that there was a an organization helping families who had just been released from these detention facilities, given a one-way ticket. $50 is what we got when we were released, and they got a bus ticket. So we started by sharing our stories. And my brother, who's for the most part pretty reticent, quiet, shy guy, was so moved by the determination he saw in these mothers. And he stood up and he said, we're here, we want to give you hope that we were incarcerated as children. We suffered the consequences of being discriminated and suffering from racism. And yet we survived. We're here and we want to offer you support, and that you too need to stay strong and survive this atrocity that's been perpetrated. We're all crying. And this mother stood up, she had her baby in her arms, and she said, I have just been released from the detention facility after 3 months. And when I think that you were held for more than 4 years, I can hardly bear the pain that you suffered. And she was crying. And I was so moved. I was thinking, here's someone who's just suffered this horrible separation and loss, and she's shedding tears for us. And to have someone cry for us, it was so healing. The connection, the human connection that we shared, and the love and the caring that could still survive this kind of deadening killing of our spirits. And it gave me and everybody else in our group hope. And we renewed our commitment to continue our work, to show up at these detention sites and share our stories, and demanding that the U.S. government stop repeating history. You know, I'm proud that I'm going to be 80 and that I survived. I don't feel like I had a choice about writing this book. I felt like, in many ways, the way my parents saved their letters and their diaries and their poems, it was, they were asking me to not let their story die.
Satsuki Ina's new book is The Poet and the Silk Girl, a memoir of love, imprisonment, and protest. And that's it for the California Report magazine for this week. Our senior editor is Victoria Mauleon. Susie Racho is our producer-director. This segment was produced by Jessica Carissa. Our sound engineer is Brendan Willard. Lucen Mendel is our intern. And I'm Sasha Coca. You can catch all of our California stories on our podcast, The California Report Magazine. Your state, your stories.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app, Star One Credit Union, in your best interest. Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.